This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/marketplace.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of February 11th, 2011. The day of wine and roses and chocolate is upon us, and many of you lovebirds are out buying a bunch of stuff for your sweetheart. But not everyone can afford to date.
You do have to kind of show that gesture of, you know, I like you, I'd like to see you again. So much so, I will pay for dinner.
We'll hear what it's like to woo while unemployed. Reverse mortgages are marketed as a great way for older adults to get their hands on some extra cash, but do not skip the fine print.
Someone's going to give you $50,000 and say, okay, you don't have to pay us back until you're not here anymore. There's going to be a catch to that.
There certainly is. Plus, we take chisel to stone for a new set of commandments.
It drives me crazy when I hear this advice given to average working families. Oh, you should have 9 months' worth of expenses in an emergency fund. Who are these people kidding?
Those stories and more coming up, but first, is there any bigger boogeyman than the banks? The nation's money holders earned more than their share of scorn and rotten tomatoes over the last couple of years, mostly for all the newfangled financial products they designed that promptly landed the country into a pickle. But some of the things that drive us bank customers bonkers are old-fashioned transactions, like when you deposit a check and it takes 2 decades to clear. Okay, a few days, but you get my point. Especially when they have no problem clearing the checks that you write. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore feels your pain and set out to get some answers.
No one uses checks anymore, right? Everything's so electronic now. Carrying a check around feels like paying in beads and wampum or using an abacus.
And this will be going into your checking account?
But when you work for yourself, as I did until recently, you don't have direct deposit. You wait weeks and often months, carrying checks lovingly to the bank, and you feel relief that you can pay your bills. Then the whammy. All that money isn't going to be available for days.
4 days? What are they doing? Reading the biographies of all the bank board of directors or what?
That's freelance writer Martha Steger. She rents out her parents' old farm in Virginia, but the tenants' checks take time to clear. So to avoid a crunch, she pays the farm's bills out of her own money first. A lot of small business owners share her resentment. Randy Minotaur, for instance, does public relations in Rochester, New York. With the bad economy, companies often take longer to pay her, which makes check holds all the more infuriating. She changed banks several times to get her checks cleared faster, but it's always the same story.
Sometimes that money just doesn't come in quite when you want it to, and to have the banks hold it up another 3 days is a tremendous inconvenience for a sole proprietor.
Banks protest that the vast majority of checks do clear in less than 2 days. Checks over $5,000 can get held up for up to 7 days. One common conspiracy theory is that banks hold your money so they can earn interest on it. When the Fed paid banks 5%, sure. But for 0.25%, banks don't bother, says Bob Mira, an analyst with research firm Celent.
In today's environment, that's not interesting at all to banks.
So, why are banks holding up your check?
The reason customers don't get money from checks immediately is that the checks may be returned as unpayable. And if the customer's already spent the money, the bank may suffer the loss.
That's Nessa Fettis, a top lawyer for the American Bankers Association. She says banks lost $1 billion on bad checks in 2008. And verifying a paper check is still pretty time-consuming. Here's how it works. When you deposit a paper check, your bank sends it to a processing center. The Fed used to have 46 of those, but with people writing fewer checks, the Fed has just one now. It's in Cleveland. That slows things down. Then the check has to make a round trip between your bank and the bank that pays it. All told, the circuit can take around 6 days, and technology doesn't fix everything.
More and more, there is an electronic aspect to check processing, but unlike credit cards, it is not, nor will it ever be, entirely electronic.
All is not lost, however. If your bank likes you, the manager can give you your money faster.
Many banks will provide quicker availability for good customers, so people should ask for sooner availability if they need it.
Just don't accept one common excuse. It doesn't take longer if your check is from another state. I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace Money.
All right, so how many times on this program do you think that we've talked about index funds?
The low-cost index fund movement revolutionized investing for ordinary folks, and for the better.
Buy mutual funds, and furthermore, buy index mutual funds that follow the market as a whole.
Yeah, lots of times. Too many to count. Mostly in the service of reminding you that index funds are safer than individual stocks. But index funds are a broad category of investing, and they're getting broader. This week, the Wall Street Journal profiled something called alternative indexes. Good excuse for us to spend a little time on Wall Street this hour. Josh Brown is an investment advisor at Fusion Analytics in New York, and I asked him to start by giving us a sense of just how diverse the market is for index funds.
Well, you have your traditional indexes to start, which most people are familiar with.
Right.
The S&P 500 can be accessed a variety of ways. Most people use the spider funds, SPY. You've also got the same thing for the Dow, for the NASDAQ. And in recent years, we've seen index funds launch for virtually every market around the world. Now we're seeing a whole new crop of index funds, which are indexes, but they are created to capture different aspects of stocks.
Right. Yeah, and that's really why we wanted to talk to you, because I saw this article in the Wall Street Journal about alternatively weighted indexes. So
right.
Let's talk first about how the traditional indexes are weighted. Explain that for us.
So there are two types of traditional index weightings. The first and most well-known would be the Dow Jones, which is a price-weighted index. What that means is the higher the price of the stock, the more weight it carries when they calculate the index. So in other words, IBM is the highest priced stock in the Dow. So as you know, it's over $100 a share. So as a result, it carries the most import on the Dow Jones index's daily fluctuation.
Okay.
The other type is the way the S&P is done, which is a cap weighted or market cap weighted index. Companies like ExxonMobil and Microsoft, which have the biggest market caps, tend to have the most weight in terms of what the S&P has done in a given day, week, or month. Now you're seeing new products roll out where they're saying, okay, instead of having an S&P 500 that's cap-weighted, what if we took all 500 stocks and we weighted them equally, 0.2%? So 500 stocks have a weighting of, you know, an equal amount for each stock. That way we capture a little bit more of a flavor of what the entire stock market has done, as opposed to having the top 10 companies dominate the performance.
And that's really interesting because, you know, I think when a lot of your average investors think about the S&P 500, they actually think that it's just you're just getting a big bucket of 500 of the biggest stocks that are out there in the marketplace. And I don't know that folks really understand that there's a weighting that goes on there.
Yeah, Tess, you know, if you look at the NASDAQ 100, and this is a really exacerbated example of what can happen in terms of companies growing so large that they skew the index. Apple Computer right now is a 20% weighting within the NASDAQ 100, just purely by virtue of the fact that a lot of NASDAQ companies like Cisco and Microsoft have done nothing over 10 years, whereas Apple has gone up and up and up and up to the point where it is a fifth of the NASDAQ 100.
Hmm.
So when people think they're buying the NASDAQ, you know, they are getting
really
some
a lot
exposure.
Of Apple.
They're getting a lot of Apple. Now,
yeah.
That's been a good thing over the last 5 years as Apple has launched product after product
right. And
has continually climbed higher. But do you necessarily want to have an index fund that's 20% weighted toward Apple if, heaven forbid, they happen to stumble on a new product launch?
Well, so for those folks who perhaps might be interested in doing this in, say, an IRA or a brokerage account, how do they know if this is something that they want to do?
For IRA accounts or just regular brokerage accounts, I think with these types of products, they're so new that the average investor should probably allow for them to trade for a few quarters before they jump on. The reason why I say that is you always have these concerns with index products and with any ETF, frankly, of what's called tracking error. In other words, yes, this is what we believe the product will do. We're rolling it out with the intention to track the equal-weighted S&P 500. But we really don't know until there's some trading history whether or not it'll accomplish that.
All right. Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, great explainer. Thanks so much for helping us out.
Oh, I hope I was helpful. Thanks for having me on.
And by the way, you can find Josh on Twitter at Reformed Broker. I highly recommend you follow him. And while you're at it, follow my tweets. I'm at Radio Tess. So if we walk up to you on the street someday and ask to see what's in your wallet, don't look at us like we're crazy. Play along for a segment we call What's in Your Wallet?
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Curtis Guy. I'm in the middle of Union Square in the city of San Francisco. This wallet does have special meaning. It's an old wallet, but I got this wallet about 3 years ago when I visited Tokyo, and I've been actually holding on to it ever since. I, by far, rather would carry a credit card or a debit card. I had a very unfortunate situation once of being robbed, and I had a lot of cash on me. And, of course, I took a total loss on the cash. So that's why I prefer to carry either a debit card or a credit card. In my wallet, I have 2 bus passes. I have a check deposit slip from a couple days ago. And I have a receipt from some coffee. Oh, and then a receipt from Church's Chicken. I'm sort of a pack rat. I just take receipts and just put them in my wallet, just kind of keep them there. I don't know why I do that. I just need to just throw them away.
This week's wallet was opened by Janae Darden. Tell us the best story in your wallet by posting on our Facebook page. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. And this is that handsome fellow from the Rockford Files.
Hi, this is James Garner for Financial Freedom. If you're 62 or older and own your own home, I'd like to talk to you about something you should know. It's called a reverse mortgage, and it's a safe, easy way to quickly turn your home equity into tax-free money. Now, I got to tell you, I was...
These commercials are everywhere nowadays. A couple of decades ago, only about 150 people a year took out reverse mortgages. Last year, more than 100,000 did. They are popular, but they can also be confusing and potentially expensive, Sally Herships reports.
Caroline Russell is 69. She and her husband live in rural Oregon. They retired a few years ago. They were hoping to spend their winters in Arizona, but they just didn't have the money to cover their living expenses, especially the payments on their $250,000 mortgage.
The cost for our mortgage with insurance and taxes was more than half of our total income, and it just overwhelmed us.
Then Russell's husband saw an ad on TV for a reverse mortgage. It said they could get a loan on their house, and the best part was they wouldn't need to pay back a single penny as long as they stayed in the house. So last year they took out a reverse mortgage and paid off the mortgage they already had. But how exactly does a reverse mortgage work? The answer turned out to be so complex, I had to ask 2 experts. First, Charlene Crowell. She works for the Center for Responsible Lending in North Carolina.
A reverse mortgage is actually a home equity conversion.
Basically, you convert some of the value in your home into cash. The Russells were able to get just over $260,000, but it's not a home equity loan. A reverse mortgage doesn't have to be repaid until you move out of your house or die, and it's only available to seniors, 62 and older. But there is a but. Expert number 2.
Someone's going to give you $50,000 and say, okay, you don't have to pay us back until you're not here anymore. There's going to be a catch to that.
Sandy Becker is a certified counselor with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. She says even though interest rates on reverse mortgages are often lower than home equity loans, reverse mortgages are ultimately a lot more expensive. The Russells got a great interest rate on their loan, under 2%, but they also paid for the privilege, $14,000 in extra costs.
So right off the bat, there are closing costs. And the closing costs are usually higher than a normal home equity loan would be.
Becker says reverse mortgages also require mortgage insurance, typically 2% of your home's value. It's to protect the lender in case the value of your house doesn't appreciate. The Russells paid about $5,000 for their mortgage insurance and an additional $5,200 in administrative fees. And there are other strings attached. Back to expert number one, Charlene Kroll with the Center for Responsible Lending.
You can't let the home fall into disrepair. You must pay your property taxes on time. You must have insurance in force. If you don't have those three things in place, then you will be in default.
Both Kroll and Becker say reverse mortgages are complex financial products. If seniors don't understand the details, the loan can become a burden. Marguerite Gabrielli is 58. She's too young for a reverse mortgage, but her mom took one out on the duplex she and Gabrielli shared in Buffalo, New York. Then this spring, her mom passed away. Soon after, Gabrielli says she got a letter from the bank demanding $30,000.
Yeah, it says right on there that they're going to foreclose if you don't meet it in 30 days. I mean, it's 9 days after she died. Repayment of the loan.
Back in 2002, Gabrielli's mom took out a reverse mortgage for $15,000. Now, with all the fees and interest, the amount has doubled. Gabrielli says she thought she'd be able to handle the loan like a credit card bill by making monthly payments.
But that's not how it worked, because they want all the money up front.
All seniors who want these types of loans are required to talk to a counselor certified by HUD. Mortgage counselor Sandy Becker advises talking to someone local. They may know about alternative loan programs for seniors in their community. Becker says reverse mortgages should only be used as a last resort. But she agrees they can be helpful in the right circumstances. Back in Oregon, Caroline Russell told me when her reverse mortgage came through, she and her husband were so relieved they went to a drive-in and had hamburgers and milkshakes.
Chocolate. That was our big celebration for hoping that we were going to be okay.
And Russell says they are okay. They even went to Arizona last winter, thanks to the reverse mortgage. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Thou shalt not use thy home as a piggy bank. Thou shalt not avoid risk, embrace it, but sensibly. Thou shalt pay off debt the smart way, and treat thy marriage like a business. Thus readeth the new Ten Commandments of Money, according to Moses Weston. Liz Pulliam Weston, our good friend, author, call answerer, and more. Her new book, The Ten Commandments of Money, arrives as we all figure out how to navigate post-economic Armageddon. Glad to have you back, Liz.
Thank you, Tess.
The title of this book really suggests, I guess, to borrow a phrase from Bill Maher, we've got some new rules when it comes to money management.
Yeah, that's the thing. The rules that we were sort of living by in the bubble years blew up on us. And I think people who thought they knew how things worked and that they were masters of the universe and they were great investors, which is, easy thing to think when everything's going well, everything blew up on them and they realized, hey, maybe I don't understand how things work. But we can't go back to the rules that our grandparents used because the world's just changed too much.
Well, one of the first things that you talk about is the monthly budget. You've got something that you call the 50-30-20 plan. Tell us what that is.
This is a plan that was actually created by Elizabeth Warren. She's the Harvard bankruptcy professor, and she has interviewed so many families in trouble, and she came up with this budget as a way to kind of pound home the point that you have to have a balanced financial life, And the key part of this is the 50%. That's the must-haves. So you take 50% of your after-tax income, and that's what you should be spending on things like shelter, transportation, insurance, minimum loan payments, childcare, all that stuff that you can't really put off without serious consequences. Mm-hmm. So if you keep the must-haves to 50%, then you've got 30% you can spend on fun, on vacations and eating out and clothes.
Yay.
And yeah, the good stuff. And then 20% goes for paying down debt and savings.
And, when we talk about having a savings cushion, you say actually that cash should not be the only thing that's in the emergency fund.
It drives me crazy when I hear this advice given to average working families. Oh, you should have 9 months worth of expenses in an emergency fund. Who are these people kidding? I mean, I go through the math in the book, but really, the typical working family, it can take years just to get 3 months' expenses saved up. So my point with this is you need to have a survival plan that has cash in it. I'm not denigrating emergency funds. You should start one. But that also gives you access to credit because you never know what's going to happen to you.
I want to talk about college education because if we talk about the rules that have become outdated, there is one old one that says that student loan is good debt.
Yes.
And let's talk a little bit about some of your thoughts on paying for college and the kind of education that a person needs to plan for.
One of the things that we really need to understand is that there are two kinds of student loans. There's federal student loans, which are fixed rate. They are filled with consumer protections, and there's only so much of that debt you can get. That is still good debt. Private student loans are a whole different matter, and I don't think people make the distinction enough. Private student loans don't have those consumer protections. They're variable rate, and like federal student loans, you can't get rid of them. So it's like paying for your education with credit cards, except you can't discharge them in bankruptcy. So starting with that, we have to understand that there's a limit to how much college education we can buy. And people don't like to hear that. You know, it's like, I want my dream school. I want to give my kid the best possible education. Money shouldn't factor into it. Well, money does factor into it. And if you have to borrow more for an education than you expect to make the first year you're out of school, you probably can't afford that education. And that's a
Your first year out of school.
Yeah. So if you expect to come out of school and make $40,000, you shouldn't be borrowing more than that to pay for your education.
That is not the calculation that's being done right now. I mean, I can't even tell you how many times we have listeners call in and tell us that they've got $100,000 in student debt, $150,000 in student debt, and they just kind of assumed that there was going to be a job market out there and that they were going to be able to pay it back. And I don't know that people are making the calculation of what the value is going to be of that education.
No, and it's a lot to expect for an 18-year-old to figure this out.
Sure.
You know, probably they don't even know what their major is going to be.
Yeah.
How are they going to know what they, you know, are going to want to do when they get out?
We've talked about this before, and I think your commandments play into this, which is my skepticism about whether these new habits, these new rules that we're wanting to follow right now, because we've got 2 years of history behind us of really tough history, whether that's going to stick.
Well, I was just being shepherded around New York while I was flogging my book by a 20-something publicist, and my editor of the book is also pretty young. I've seen a profound change, and they've seen a profound change in their generation. You know, it's not unusual for 20-somethings to have a few jobs, you know, not just one, but you'd have a side job. You know, we've gone from this situation where the baby boomers were complaining about the younger generations. Oh, they want everything right away.
Right.
And, you know, now it just seems like they're happy to have a job. So I don't know for sure. I don't think we can change the baby boomers. I think as soon as credit comes back, you know, they'll be back to their profligate ways. I think there's going to be a difference in the 20 or 30-somethings because they came into this with, you know, some pretty high expectations that were profoundly dashed. And they're seeing their friends with good educations from good schools struggling to find and keep jobs. And that has got to have a profound effect on how you look at security, how you look at risk, how you look at jobs.
Liz Pauline Weston is a personal finance columnist with MSN, and her newest book is titled The 10 Commandments of Money: Survive and Thrive in the New Economy. And I'll tell you, you follow these and you just might be able to do that. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tess.
And I mentioned earlier that you can find me tweeting at Radio Tess. You can also find Liz chirping at Liz Weston. Here's one more commandment that I would add to the mix. Thou shalt not ask me for my zip code when I'm paying for my merchandise. Why, oh, why, cashier, do you need to know that?
The most common reason they ask for it is for market research, for knowing where the people that are shopping there are coming from.
Chris Moran is the senior editor at Consumerist.com.
Some of them are reselling that information, some of them aren't. And, you know, some of these places go so far as to ask you for your address or your phone number.
But here in California, they cannot ask us that anymore. A woman sued Williams-Sonoma for pestering her with the zip code question. This week, the California Supreme Court ruled in her favor, overturning two lower court rulings. Moran says this week's decision relied on protections already in place for California consumers.
In California, there was a law passed saying that retailers are not allowed to ask for private address information. And the California Supreme Court decided that a zip code, since it's part of your address, falls under that existing law.
Now, of course, the woman could have just said she didn't want to give that number out. And retailers can still ask for identification when you hand over your credit card, but they cannot record that information. Now, for all of you who do not live in the Golden State, Moran offers this tip.
One of our editors historically given the zip code for Wrigley Field in Chicago.
And that number is 60613.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. Visit squarespace.com/marketplace and sign up for a free trial. Then choose a design and color scheme that's uniquely you. That's squarespace.com/marketplace. We thank Squarespace for their support.
So there's this holiday coming up on Monday, full of chocolates and flowers and twice the usual price, dinner's out. This is also the busiest time of year for online dating websites, according to OkCupid, which is an online dating website. Single people bursting with New Year's resolutions apparently sign up at twice the usual rate between January 1st and Valentine's Day. Dating is never easy, at least from what I can remember, and it can be especially tricky when you're unemployed. Ashley Milne-Tite has the latest in our effort to be the most unromantic program on the radio.
Mark Harm lives in Denver. He worked in TV production till he lost his job last April. He's always telling himself it's not him, it's the economy. But he can't help feeling low sometimes. He's 37 and he'd like to meet someone, but the idea of wooing women while he's out of work just doesn't appeal.
It's a confidence issue. I think when you have financial confidence, you have social confidence.
Harm gets $400 a week in unemployment benefits, and his family's helping him out with some loans so he doesn't fall behind on bills and his mortgage. But he still has to pinch pennies. The condo he owns needs work. He'd be pretty embarrassed to have a date over right now.
This carpeting is just so old, and it's flat.
Then there's the ancient couch. But home improvements will have to wait till he finds work. So will dating.
Starting a relationship is almost like going to a job interview. Everybody at one point or another always asks that same question, what do you do for a living? And it's just been very tough for me to admit that right now I'm not working, I was laid off, and I'm looking for my next opportunity, that kind of thing.
Terry Setzer isn't dating either, but not because he lacks confidence. Setzer is 25, gay, and lives in New York. He was laid off from his job as a database manager in September, but feels he's pretty close to landing a new position. We met in a bar where he used to bring dates in better times. He says his problem is he has a stereotype to live down.
In the homosexual community, gay community, it's not good to have a man who's unemployed because it's so typical for African-American gay men to be unemployed.
Setzer says he's proud and used to paying his way. He likes the good life and can't imagine dating on the cheap.
Every time I think about dating, it always involves money because usually, say you want to eat in, you have to pay for the food.
These days, his dinner consists of a deli sandwich, but he won't serve that unimpressive fare to anyone else. But not everyone is reluctant to put themselves out there. Sam Yagan is co-founder of the dating website OkCupid. He and I are searching the site for people who admit they're unemployed. We come across the profile of a very attractive blonde woman.
Could you read that out?
Sure. I'm an unemployed lawyer who will hopefully be getting an offer for a public defender position any day now.
That's a very positive
That's a positive one. I've been unemployed for most of the year and decided to take some time for myself.
We see this repeatedly. Women, usually in their 20s and early 30s, who paint unemployment as a time for self-discovery rather than a downer. But we could only find a couple of men who said they were unemployed. Psychologist Nancy Molitor says that's not surprising. She practices just outside Chicago and says her out-of-work male clients don't fare well once they reveal their job status.
Even now, even in this age, in the 21st century, the men will often tell me that when they call the woman back, they won't typically get the second call, or they get the second call, the woman has sort of backed off.
Many of these guys earned well until they lost their jobs in finance or real estate. Often their whole identity was tied up with their work and earning power. Now, she says, they see themselves as useless.
They will come in with sort of faulty thinking, telling me that I'm a loser, I'm never going to find a woman, and nobody's ever going to want me, what's wrong with me?
As a psychologist, Molitor encourages these men to look at their lives from a different perspective. She also suggests more economical ways to date. But she says they feel downcast for good reason. Many women seeking relationships still see money as a huge draw. As for her female clients, while some retreat from the dating scene when they lose their jobs, others date more.
I had one woman candidly tell me that she couldn't afford to eat. Certainly not go out to the restaurants that she liked to go out to if she didn't have a boyfriend who would pay for everything. And she's very clear about that. She doesn't feel any discomfort about it.
In Denver, Mark Harm is in no position to be anyone's meal ticket. When you've been out of work for almost a year, even dinner and a movie can add up. He'd love to take someone out.
You do have to kind of show that gesture of, you know, I like you, I'd like to see you again. So much so, I will pay for dinner.
To do that, he needs to get the job, then get the girl. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
Now it's the time of the show when we answer your money questions. David Lazarus is the consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and he answers money riddles all day long and helps us out with some of our questions, too. Hi, David.
Hey.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, thank you, Taz. I was going to give you your thing a little later. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, how much of a romantic are you? What do you spend on Valentine's Day?
I'm insufferable as a romantic. I'm the kind of guy who thinks, you know, just popping up with flowers is great.
Aww.
You know, I know it's pathetic. It really is. It's probably way against the guy code. I don't know. But
you're still married.
I am. So I must be doing something right.
Well, Reuters came out with some information this week that says that the average amount that couples spend for Valentine's Day is $189. And if you're a yuppie, if you're a youngster, you're spending $255 on Valentine's Day.
Who does that?
I don't know.
I'm feeling so cheap suddenly.
Well, and I'm feeling really cheap because this is a holiday that my husband and I ignore.
Why?
It's a Hallmark holiday.
Well, yeah, it's that, but it's also a kind of a I love you holiday.
I don't need a special day out of the year to know that I am loved and that I love him.
But it's nice.
And spend all kinds of money telling him so.
So what do you wait till Arbor Day for this?
Well, yes. It's a very special day in our household.
Here, honey, here's a tree. I'm growing on you.
Well, so I actually posted this on our Facebook and asked some of our friends what they were planning to spend for Valentine's Day. And Elizabeth McConnell Sutton said that they might spend $25 if they go out to dinner. Other than that, they buy chocolates the day after when it goes on sale. And Tom Keyes said, including the stuff, quote unquote, from the kids, probably less than $30. And money is mostly going toward heating bills and folks to break up the ice on the roof these days.
All true there.
Must be an East Coaster or Midwesters somewhere. Yeah.
When it comes to the from the kids stuff, too, this is one of those occasions when I think it's really nice to get the kids involved. And I'll always ask my son to make a card for Mama on these days. I just think even though he you know, only phones it in, you know, and he basically, you know, Mama, thanks for everything. I love you. One of those kind of things. All right, fine. But it's one of those nice occasions where you get them involved as well. And that's
absolutely
nice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's see how this Valentine's weekend is treating our callers. Jim and Judy are with us from Bloomington, Minnesota. Hi, Jim and Judy.
Hello.
Hello.
This is so fun to have both of you on.
Yes.
What are you planning to do for Valentine's Day?
Funny you should ask. For 43 years, we have made Valentines for each other and exchanged them on Valentine's Day.
I love this.
That's too cute. That really is.
And we don't go out. We don't spend money.
How old are you guys?
Oh, 70, low 70s.
I love this.
I want to be this couple when I get into that
age.
I
do too. Yeah. So is this something that you do with crayons?
Oh, no. Each one secretly does their own. Mine tend to be a little fancier because I have all the equipment.
You mean you have the Elmer's glue?
Yes.
Okay. Got it.
Exactly.
But we
do have quite a collection, having done it for 40 years.
So you've kept all of them?
Oh, yes.
Well, so seeing as you've been married for more than 40 years, you must agree on everything, right?
Oh, absolutely.
We have a lot of discussions.
And when it comes to money?
Yes, we've always had some discussions when it comes to money.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, why we're calling you. We have, you know, we're retired, but we're to the point in our lives where we're not rich, but we're comfortable. We don't have any debt. We maintain a $35,000 in a just regular checking, you know, savings, but checking, and you don't make any interest on anything. So what it gets down to is that we like to travel. We travel a lot, and there are some months where we spend everything that's coming in.
Well, what is coming in? We haven't established that. I hear your savings, but do you have a pension or something else that's paying
off? I've got a really rock-solid pension plus Social Security. So our annual income is, between $70,000 and $80,000.
Okay. Well, so it sounds like you're asking about priorities in terms of how much travel you can do?
Well, actually, what we've been having a discussion about is I thought that we should just be prudent and put a little bit more into the savings each month. And my husband thinks that we have enough.
Ah, okay.
That's the discussion point.
It's a discussion.
And that's why we got in touch with you.
They're discussing this.
A neutral third party mediator.
Well, David, it does seem that this is a matter of priorities, assuming that nothing goes wrong.
Well, first of all, let's give big props to Jim and Judy, not just because they're just sickly romantic.
Yes.
Okay. But aside from that, they're pretty good with their finances. That said, I'm on your side, Judy, on this one. And that's because I think 70 is the new 60 when it comes to your retirement years. You're probably going to be living longer. So I would say that point where you can say, let's just start living off the income or even chewing into any capital or principal that we have, you're not there yet. And so, Judy, I think your prudence is very warranted at this point.
Thank you. It's so nice to chat with you today.
Oh, please. Yeah, I know. You're going to be my Valentine next if I keep this up.
Oh, yes.
So what do you guys think?
Well,
Jim?
I certainly accept the decision of the court.
I told him I'd win. I told him I would win.
This is why these two get on so well, right?
Can I go a slightly different direction? We don't have any long-term care insurance, which is probably the one thing that would knock us for a loop if one of us should need some long-term care.
I appreciate what you're doing, but, you know, health care is one of those things that you need to be very vigilant about. And you've got other things to think about as well, such as whether you and Judy might want to shift gears into an assisted living community. My grandparents ended up in one, and they were very, very happy there. But they laid the groundwork in advance to know that when it was time for them to get into an assisted living situation, they knew where they were going to go. They already had their place booked, and that takes a little bit of money.
Right. That is how we were thinking about it. So that is a possibility that we should explore anyway.
I have complete confidence that Jim and Judy are going to do the right thing.
You're definitely going to get a Valentine.
I'm fishing for one. Yeah, come on. So I think that whatever happens, whatever life throws at these two, they're going to be okay.
That sound good, you guys?
Yes, it does. Very good. Thank you very much.
Very happy Valentine's to you, and thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
All right, let's go to Scott, and he's right here in Los Angeles. Hi, Scott.
Hi there.
Got any plans for Valentine's Day?
Yeah, probably go swing dancing.
Swing dancing?
Yeah.
Ooh, fun.
Big bad voodoo daddy.
Yes, ma'am.
What was that? David just like pointed his finger at me. I'm not sure what
as
that means.
So there. See, you got to get it, Scott. See, anytime I get any kind of cultural reference, there is complete mystification here at Marketplace that, oh, my God, David actually knows something about pop culture.
Okay, so from swing dancing, is this something that perhaps you do for a living?
I don't dance for a living. If
you
only I was that good. No, I'm an actor for a living.
Oh, well, of course.
Of course.
Have we seen you in anything?
I did a lot of stage for many years, and I've just moved out to L.A. a few years ago to do TV and film.
What's your favorite part?
Oh, gosh, probably Macbeth.
Give us a line.
Oh, guys, it's a dagger which I see before me, the handle towards my hand.
Very nice.
I'm ready to go wash my hands right now. That's,
I know.
There you
well, David,
go.
I hear you used to be an actor, right?
How did you know this?
We actors
what?
Talk.
Oh, my goodness.
And,
my dirty
story,
little secrets. See, now, and here, now here's Tess dragging it all out. And you want to know what happened here? Obviously, Scott did a web search. And, yes, I had a speaking part in the Bad News Bears.
No!
Oh, and here's Tess rolling on the floor. This is the road not taken. I could have been the next Brad Pitt. I could have been the next George Clooney, but no. Now, for anybody who's wondering where it was, I appear at different times in the film. I wasn't a bear. I was a Yankee. But my key moment comes at the end of the film where the Yankees win the big game. They get presented with the trophy. That's me receiving the trophy. And then I give the big speech.
We just want to say you guys played a good game.
And we treated you pretty unfair all season. We want to apologize.
Hey, Yankees, you can take your apology out of your trophy and shove it straight up your...
I hear Netflix queues being changed all over the country.
I'm really sorry that all had to come out today.
Oh, my goodness.
No, I'm glad. No.
I am speechless.
Yeah, I know. But put it together
okay,
now.
I'm going to pull it together
pull
now.
It together.
Okay, so, Scott.
Yes.
So how can we help you out today? Enough fun and hilarity.
Enough fun and hilarity. Well, I have an interesting tax Schedule C question. Last year, I did quite fine on stage when people couldn't see my teeth up close. But when I got onto TV and film, my teeth up close were just a disaster.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, since I was a child of struggling with my teeth. I got some work done a long time ago, but it was time to be redone, especially when I saw myself in commercials with my ugly teeth splashed across the screen.
So your agent says, Scott?
My agent said, Scott, you got to do something about those teeth.
Yeah, otherwise, it's not Macbeth. It's going to be Caliban from this point on.
You are good, David.
Another good reference.
Yeah, you are.
There you go.
So anyway, I spent a lot of money on these teeth.
How much? How much?
30 grand.
So the question here presumably is, can you deduct this as a business expense?
Can I deduct it as a business expense? How do I document it?
Well, David, I know you're not a tax expert, but is this something that we have an answer for?
Yeah, we do. Darn tootin', this is a business expense.
Really?
I know for a fact, because I read a lot, not through any personal kind of thing, that strippers and whatnot can claim breast implants as a business expense.
They cannot.
They can.
Gee, maybe I should get some breast implants.
or whatever. I don't know.
Whatever you need.
And I'm just
whatever
saying,
your agent says.
And this is because I read a lot. I really want to emphasize that. And if that's where the precedent lies, then I would think if you're an actor and you're in commercials, then good teeth has to be a business expense.
Yeah.
Then how does he prove that this was necessary for him to get work?
What you can do, Scott, is demonstrate how much of your career took off after the work, and I'm guessing that might have happened.
Oh, yeah. The month after the work was finished, I've actually done enough work in the last couple of months to almost cover it.
You know what you could
do?
Yeah.
You could probably get an affidavit from whatever producer hired you for those gigs, attesting to the fact that they liked your smile and it was a factor in the decision to hire you.
Okay.
Well, so that gives you a pretty nice answer there, Scott, huh?
My teeth and I both thank you guys.
You are most welcome. Good luck with the career.
Thank you so much.
All right, and finally we have Catherine, and she is in San Jose, California. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. My producer tells me that we were barely able to get you this morning because you're on your way to some sporting event?
Yes, I'm going to be a volunteer marshal at the AT&T Pebble Beach tournament this weekend.
Wow, fun.
Wait, what does a marshal do?
A marshal basically handles crowd control.
Yeah, are you the one holding up the sign that says shh?
Exactly.
Who's playing? Is Tiger playing at this one?
Oh, absolutely. Tiger, Phil, everybody.
All I know from golf is when there's a windmill, you've got to get it under the windmill blade to get it through the thing. I mean, that's all I know.
So have you done this before? Is this something that you travel around doing?
No, I've done a couple of tournaments.
How do you keep the peace as a marshal? I mean, if somebody refuses to shut up during putt time or
tackle
whatever
them.
It's called.
I think the trick is to kill them with kindness.
So this is why you're good at this and I wouldn't be.
We'll see.
So what can we help you out with today?
Well, I purchased a home almost 5 years ago, and I had originally a first and a second loan. And
so you had a piggyback, an 80-20?
Yes, exactly. Okay. I refinanced with my credit union to bring my business back to them.
Okay.
It was a 5-1 ARM, and they never sold it, so they still continue to own my loan.
Can I ask what the amount of the loan is?
The loan is around $713,000.
Okay. So how is your house value doing?
Not so well.
Hmm.
It's in the mid-5s.
Hmm.
I'm getting concerned because the 5-year portion of the ARM is about 15 months away.
Right.
When you hit that threshold, how much are you expecting your mortgage payments to go up?
About $2,000.
Wow. And that's on a home that you're underwater on.
Exactly.
So I'm guessing you're wondering whether you should walk away or tough it out?
Well, I love my home. I think that's a consistent refrain from folks nowadays, and I'd rather not walk away from it.
Yeah.
What my question is, we hear a lot about the federal programs that are available to homeowners if they're in a Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae mortgage. I don't have a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac mortgage. My mortgage is privately held. So my question is, what options are there available to folks who are underwater on a mortgage that's privately held?
Well, first of all mortgages are privately held, right, David? It's just that some are backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, but that doesn't mean that Fannie and Freddie hold those mortgages.
No. It means that Fannie and Freddie have helped finance the mortgage.
Exactly.
Okay.
But there is a question of how you can refinance if you are not in a conventional Fannie Freddie backed loan.
And in fact, the Obama administration has really tried to make an effort to prod lenders into modifying these loans, especially for people just like Catherine, mm-hmm. who want to stay in their home but have found themselves in a difficult situation and now want to do the right thing. And the banks have decided, you know, it's just too hard to wrestle with all these mods. And interestingly, when I talk to bank executives about this, the banks consistently say, well, we'd like to do that, but it's too cumbersome. It's easier as a national bank to have a set-in-stone policy and then follow that policy for everybody. And that's why people like Catherine end up finding themselves hitting a brick wall.
Well, Catherine, you are back with your credit union. Have you talked to them about any options that you might have?
I have. I actually was doing some research last summer and found a program that was for loans that, and I'll use the right term, aren't backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac.
And will your credit union do this with you?
Well, I sent them the information, and they came back and said no, they would not do that.
Why? Uh-huh. What are the grounds?
My mortgage guy just said they would lose too much money if they did this for everybody.
Right. But then so the other option that you have is to walk away and then the bank loses everything.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's exactly what Catherine needs to do. She needs to go back to that credit union, sit down with the manager and say, I've spoken to my financial advisors. I've spoken to my CPA. I've spoken to all of my people. And here's the situation that we're looking at. I'm either going to walk away from this loan and leave you holding the bag, or you're going to work with me reasonably. I'm not trying to gouge you. I'm not trying to rip you off. You're going to work with me, and we're going to come up with some sort of way that I can stay in this house, and you're going to get your money, and everybody walks away a winner.
Little hardball there for you.
All right. I guess I'll have to be a marshal with my credit union.
There we go. I like it. Noogies. You just noogies is the answer.
Okay.
So let us know what you end up doing and how it goes.
Okay, I will. Thanks so much for your help.
You bet. Thanks so much for the call.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or you can, of course, reach us on our website. Go to the Getting Personal link. David Lazarus, it's been awfully fun, and boy, what I did not know about you. Thanks so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter. I'm at Radio Tess. Next time, there are a lot of misconceptions about what it's like to be homeless. And now there's a way for all of us to imagine just how hard it can be.
There is a stigma attached, unfortunately. And there is something to pushing that button that helps the person who's playing the game to actually feel what that's like.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
American Public Media.